This is Scenic Roots, Stalking Writing. Our guest is Margaret Renkel. Her new collection of essays, set for publication next Thursday, September 16th, titled Graceland, At Last, and subtitled Notes on Hope and Heartache from the American South, is a compilation of the weekly columns she has written for the New York Times since 2017. Nominally, the essays talk about the South from the point of view of a lifelong resident talking to the readers of the New York Times about life in the South. But as Margaret sees it, she is in fact talking about what it means to be in and of a region so thoroughly at odds with my political priorities. She is, she says, a red state liberal. In her introduction to the book, she writes, "This opportunity has been a genuine gift. A dream job for any essayist. For a lifelong Southerner writing about the South in a national newspaper, it is also a great responsibility. No other region of the country," she goes on to write, "carries so much cultural baggage. From films like Gone with the Wind and Deliverance to television shows like the Beverly Hillbillies and Nashville, decades of stereotype-driven media have filled this country with people who think they understand Southerners, even if they have never so much as visited the place. But every Monday, the Times lets me, quote, tell about the South, to borrow from William Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom, and I am inexpressibly grateful for the chance to confront and complicate the stereotypes." We began by talking about what it means to be a Southern writer. You said that maybe, and that's my emphasis, being a Southern writer is only a matter of loving a damaged and damaging place. And then you said in another essay, actually it wasn't in the essay, it was in the end notes, that you tried running away from the South for about 4 months and then came back.
That's true.
And when was this, after you were in college?
Yes, I went to graduate school in Philadelphia for one semester.
Ah.
I did not thrive. No offense to Philadelphia. The people of Philadelphia were immensely kind. It was a little disconcerting to a Southern ear to hear the gruffness sometimes in the way total stranger would just say, "Where do you need to be?" And they were trying to help me find my way because I was clearly lost. Just very kind and generous people. And the people I met in my program, many of them I'm still in touch with now after only 4 months together. It just was not my place. I'm just a homebody. And even though Nashville is 180 miles from Birmingham, where I went to school, and Birmingham is farther than that from Lower Alabama, where I spent my early childhood, it's still of a piece in a way. And I went to graduate school in South Carolina. All those places felt like home, and Philadelphia did not feel like home. It's very hard. It was very hard for me to know who I was when I didn't feel like I was in a place where I belonged. It was a kind of dislocation that's hard to describe.
To be honest with you, Margaret, when I first moved to Chattanooga, I had an extreme sense of outsiderness, and it took me a while to understand that this place that in my mind was mythic, you know, from Otis Redding and Aretha Franklin and Sammy Davis and all the music that came out of here, it took me a while to find that place that was in my imagination.
Well, I do think that people are a little bit like baby birds. We get imprinted on our homeland in a way. Even if we leave it, somehow that's become the norm. That seems to be the measure of all other places.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might be fairly universal. I don't think it's Southern. It's probably not British. It's probably all of us.
Mm, I think that's true. I have any number of friends who either wanted to do what I did or tried to do it and failed. Not because of any inherent character flaw, they just couldn't handle it. You know, it was too much. The alienness was too much. A couple of people I know tried Los Angeles. Another friend of mine landed in Texas, and he's still here. But it took him a while too. What it did for me more than anything, I think, was made me incredibly homesick for about 15 years till I finally got over it.
It's kind of a way where when you do come to feel at home in a new place, sometimes it feels really like being homesick in both places.
Yeah, thank you for that. That is so true. People don't ask me as much as they used to when the first 15 or 20 years I see people, where are you from? And it was a reasonable question, I suppose, given that I talk in a way that they probably found almost impenetrable at times, but they don't do that anymore. But I didn't know how to answer. And when people ask me that question now, I really don't know how to answer it.
Sure.
I'm from Chattanooga, you know.
When I was in Philadelphia, that one really brief period, I went to New York to see an exhibit of paintings, Van Gogh's paintings from his time in Arles, France. And I was so poor, and I took a series of commuter trains because I couldn't afford the Amtrak direct train, and I was very lost. And I knew there was no way I could find my way to the museum. And so I took a cab with this tiny little bit of money I had, and the cab driver asked me, he was clearly from somewhere in the Caribbean, and he asked me where I was from. And I said, where I was coming from. And I said, Philadelphia. And I said, where are you from? And he started laughing. He said, New York. Because he was perfectly clear that I was definitely not coming from Philadelphia. He might not know exactly where in the South I was from, but he could tell it wasn't Philadelphia.
I stayed in Queens when I first arrived in New York. And I was anxious to see Manhattan. I said, so how do I get to Manhattan? They said, well, take the subway and get off at Fifth Avenue. I said, okay. So the sign on the station said Fifth Avenue. And I'm looking, this doesn't look like Fifth Avenue. But I got off the train anyway because it said Fifth Avenue, you know. Well, it turns out that was Fifth Avenue in Queens. And I'm looking all around thinking, this can't possibly be right, you know. It just takes a while to learn how to navigate your way, doesn't it? But back to the question, which isn't really a question, but more an attempt to assay a question that's asked over and over and over again. What is it to be a Southerner in some sense, I guess, but a Southern writer? But to go back to my impressions of the South, my abiding impression of the South, which still holds, is that this is the artistic, emotional, sensual center of the country.
That's so interesting.
If you think about the music, or you think about the writers, playwrights, or novelists, an orator like Martin Luther King, it's hard to imagine those people coming from anywhere else.
I do think that's a contrary view of the South than many people outside the South hold of the people here, especially today in this very politically polarized age. People definitely don't think of us as cultured. They may understand that the roots of all American music began with enslaved people and carried through with black artists ever since, but they don't generally think of us, the whole region, that is, as an artistic mecca at all. So I'm very interested to hear you say that. Do you think you came to that opinion after living here for some time, or did you know it all along?
That was my sense of the South before I came here, but at the same time, I grew up in the 60s. And so what we knew in London of the southern states was frankly bizarre. Burning Beatle records and... I'm not sure that, to be honest with you, that I knew much about Bull Connor and all those people. That's something that I've probably learned from history classes here since being here. But I definitely had the sense that there was extreme animosity between the races here, which is such an irony because the music that came out of the South is so much a fusion of those two cultures, white and black.
Well, I think musicians were way, way, way ahead of their time, white musicians.
Yeah.
I mean, Elvis certainly knew what he was appropriating, and he wasn't alone. But I'm it's a question I ask myself often, all the time. And I think a lot of people do. I don't think I'm alone in this. Is there such a thing anymore as a Southern literature? There was, you know, for we think about the period that gave us Faulkner and Eudora Welty and Flannery O'Connor and, you know, Walker Percy, and it just, the list just goes on and on. And where are we now compared to those writers, the writers of that age? Now we have a much more multifarious culture. It's not just white writers anymore. It's not just white writers and James Baldwin. It's a lot of different kinds of writers and from a lot of different places. And what does that dilute the concept of a Southern writer? Does the way our culture, our popular culture is so centralized now, does that dilute the cultural capital we have? And sometimes I land on one side of that question and sometimes I land on others. But I do think that we retain in the South a sense of regional identity that feels to me to be different from the regional identity of other parts of the country. I might be wrong about this. I've already confessed that I've never really truly lived anywhere else, but I wonder if New Englanders think of themselves as New Englanders in the same way that Southerners think of themselves as Southerners, or Southwesterners think of themselves in the same way as we think of ourselves. I don't know, but I sense that the rest of the country definitely thinks of this region as different from all other regions in the country. Sometimes for good and more often for bad.
Yeah, it's interesting that, isn't it? I think what you're saying is absolutely true. When I told friends of mine in New York City that I was going to be moving to Chattanooga, most of them sort of scratched their head and, where's that? You know? And when I told them that it's in Tennessee, they said, oh. And there was this sense that people living in New York thought of the rest of the country as out there. Oh, it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
And like they were occupants of a highly individualized island that didn't have anything in common with the rest of the country. In fact, it wasn't even part of the country. It was an island in every sense. I have a feeling that people maybe still think that way. But then you talk about, you know, a generation of Southern writers. What comes to mind is, aside from Mary Gaucher, John Prine, Michael Stipe. John Prine's not even a Southerner, is he? He grew up in Chicago, but he's a Southerner. You know, I mean, the way he spins a lyric, that kind of storytelling.
Well, he's a storyteller. Yes. Yeah, he's a storyteller, and that is such a profound Southern trait. It's true for. I don't think there's any Southern family I know where there wasn't a grandmother or a grandfather, an aunt or an uncle, a parent who was just a raconteur. Just storytelling is endemic, really, to the region. And so, and I think John Prine, of course, John Prine had grandparents in Kentucky. And
yeah, that's true. I guess he came of age in Chicago, is the way it worked, right? But he was, as you say, you know, he's from Paradise. That's, or at least that's where his family is from, anyway. So it was in him, as they say.
And Mary's from Louisiana, and I wonder sometimes how much the lack of air conditioning has to do with that storytelling gene. You know, if it was just way too hot to be inside and you had to sit on the porch to even be able to survive, what were you going to do except tell stories?
I think the way that you say inside and survive says everything you need to know about the South. You stretch the eyes to such a degree that it gives the sense of a kind of languid, relaxed, it'll take time, but we'll get there. You know?
That's funny.
The people in the North drive them crazy. But you know, when I first moved down here, people all the time would talk about a New York minute as distinct from a minute in Memphis.
Sure. You can't move too fast when it's this hot. You really just can't.
I get that.
It's not possible.
So just to go back to your comment about the South being a damaged and damaging place, what was your attitude to the South when you were growing up? You came of age in a very difficult period, didn't you?
Well, I grew up in Alabama during the 1960s and 70s. But I was a child. I was born in 1961. So a lot of what happened in the South during the 60s was invisible to me. Yeah. We didn't move to Birmingham until 1968. And so we missed Bull Connor and his ilk. But by the time I was in middle school, certainly by high school, I understood how much about the way the South was run was exploitative, and particularly of Black people, and exclusive. Very hidebound in a way. And it just was very clear to me that this was not a place whose values I shared. That's what it seemed to me. And by the time I was ready to leave for graduate school, I thought I was leaving the South for good. I thought I was going to find a place where the people and I had more in common. And it was a failure of thinking. And it's a failure of thinking that is even more universal today than it was when I left college in 1984. Because we do have this idea, many, many of us have this idea, that we have to share the politics of somebody to be able to understand them, or to certainly to befriend them. And that's what I was thinking. That was the error of thought that led me away from home, I think, is that I wanted to be around people whose values matched my own, without giving any thought at all to the very strong reality that I had values that were an exact match for the South. I just didn't recognize them as values at the time. I was still thinking only within a political framework. And so I really think I've spent the rest of my life since then trying to reconcile what it is like to be in and of a region so thoroughly at odds with my political priorities. My people have always been a lot more than their political opinions. You know, I grew up in a house divided. My grandparents were Yellow Dog Democrats, and my parents never voted for a Democrat in their adult lives. And my grandmother was so tickled when my brother and sister and I all ended up on her side of the political aisle. But I don't remember my parents and my grandparents ever once even talking about politics. It was just, that was in the same way that you didn't presume that somebody who worshipped in a different church was somehow inferior to you. That was just, this is all a pretty new way of thinking, to divide human beings into just this even left and right, when people are always more complicated than that. My grandmother was a school teacher and an educated person, particularly for her time and place. She graduated from high school when she was 16. Somebody had to carry her to the train on a mule to get her to college. But my great-grandparents were determined that she would go to college, and she did. And I just remember that when the schools integrated, my grandfather thought there would be violence, and he begged my grandmother to retire. And my grandmother refused. She said, a child is a child. She wasn't going to retire just because they were going to put black children in her classroom. And I did not know anybody who used racist language or talked disrespectfully. How much they felt that they didn't say in my presence, I couldn't say. But it was definitely not, even in the 60s in Lower Alabama, what people imagine it must have been like. Not in my family. Not among the people my family knew, either. Of course, I grew up Catholic, and that's a little bit of a different world. You know, Catholic schools were integrated long before public schools were, and that may have had something to do with it, too. But my grandparents were certainly not Catholic. There wasn't a Catholic in the county till my mother married my father.
You come from a remarkable family. Your grandmother was a remarkable person. I mean, how many women of her generation would go to college?
Well, almost none of them did.
That's what I figured, yeah.
But there were really no options for women. My grandmother was born in 1909, and you know, by the time she was ready to work, or very soon thereafter, it was the Depression, the Great Depression, and there weren't enough jobs even for men. The job, I mean, the state of Alabama had a law forbidding married women to work for the state if they had children younger than school age at home, because they were trying to preserve those jobs for men so that every family had at least one breadwinner. But my grandfather was a farmer, and there was no surviving on what my grandfather could make. He drove the school bus in the morning, and my grandmother taught, and they were still, you know, struggling to make ends meet. But it was, I'm not going to say that my grandmother was a visionary. She had some attitudes that were definitely of her time, but she was also remarkable in her context. Extremely remarkable.
Yeah, if you'll forgive this observation, Margaret, because I don't know you, but I get the impression that you are your grandmother's granddaughter in every way.
She was a big influence on all five of her grandchildren. It's amazing how many of my mother never even once considered becoming a school teacher. She said, I watched my mother grade papers every night of my life. Do you think I would do that to myself? But then all three of my mother's children grew up to be teachers at one level or another. At least, I mean, I taught high school for 10 years. My brother is still a college professor. My sister is still a high school teacher. My first cousin, Shannon Weems Anderson, is also a college professor. I mean, she had a strong influence on all of her grandchildren.
And her great-grandchildren are, at least one of your sons is a teacher, right?
That's right. My oldest is a middle school teacher here in Nashville.
That's got to be the toughest teaching gig on the planet, teaching people that age.
Don't you know it? It is so true.
How did you come to start writing for the New York Times?
Well, very gradually, and then all at once. I was talking with an editor at the time. The editor grew up here in Nashville, Clay Risen. And he's a he he was, at the time, the deputy editor of the op-ed section at the time. But he also wrote books on the side. And he was at in Nashville for the Southern Festival of Books. And we were chatting. And I've known Clay for a long, long time. And he asked how the family was doing. And I explained that my mother-in-law was dying. And it had been, and it was just a really hard time in our family. And he gave me this funny look and he said, "Would you ever want to write about that?" And it turns out that Times was about to start a series called The End. And it was about different aspects of the end of life. Essays written by people who were dying, people who were physicians, people who were caregivers in the family, all different kinds of perspectives on the end of life. And at first I thought I wouldn't. And then I thought I might try because it might help me to sort of think through and what was happening, which was so overwhelming because my mother-in-law was dying, moving toward the end of her life in the year after my mother died. So it really just felt like mortality was all around me. And so I wrote this essay and I sent it to Clay, and Clay passed it on to the editor of the series to see if she would be interested in it, and she bought it. And a few months after it ran, I wrote an essay for a different series that the Times was running at the time. It was called Menagerie, and it was about different human-animal relationships. And I wrote about the bluebirds nesting in my yard. And they bought it, too, and then that sort of gave me courage. Every few months, I would send in another essay, and they would buy it. And I don't remember exactly how long, maybe 2 years later or so, they asked if I wanted to write once a month. And then 6 months after that, they asked me if I wanted to write every week. And that was 4 years ago or so.
The compilation of Margaret Renkel's weekly columns for the New York Times titled Graceland, At Last, is set for publication next Thursday, September 16th. Margaret Renkel will also be one of the authors at the 33rd Annual Southern Festival of Books in Nashville on October 9th and 10th. Details on the festival are on the Humanities Tennessee website. The second half of my conversation with Margaret Renkel will be on Scenic Routes, Talking Writing, next Wednesday afternoon here on Listener Supported Public Radio.